Is Leftism the Primary Cause of the Beast? The second talk at Gutenberg College's 2013 Summer Institute, How to Follow Jesus When You Cannot Kill the Beast, was presented by Charlie Dewberry on August 1, 2013. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2013. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, early in the morning, we're going to jump right into this. I want to start out with just a couple quick comments. One, this isn't the paper I had written Tuesday afternoon when we figured out what we were going to do exactly. So there's nothing like a couple of long drives home. It's an hour and a half for me to drive home. So there's nothing like an hour and a half drive to help revise papers. The second one is all of us have a unique perspective that we bring to this. And one of the things I find often in reading papers from Jack is I have a particularly torturous journey to get from what it looks like he's saying to what he's actually saying. And Jack's had to endure this for years of me asking these really stupid questions. Now, you aren't saying this, are you? I don't think you are, but I just need to clarify this. And I did send an email of that type to Jack this week. As I start here, one of the things I'm going to try to do is take you through my journey to coming to the conclusion of what I think Jack says. And luckily, he's here to say at the end, nah, Charlie, you didn't get it. That may be true. So, we'll see. The major thesis of Jack's paper is that America is rapidly morally declining and that Christianity is playing less of a role in the culture. The cause of the decline, Jack thinks, is what he calls contrabiblicism, or leftism. In this paper, I will first examine portions of Jack's analysis and point out a couple places where I'm not sure I understand his arguments and terms and what turns on them, or possibly where I disagree with his analysis. Second, I'm going to just examine his argument generally. Third, I'm going to recount what I heard Jack say leftism is. Lastly, I'll examine, if I'm convinced, whether or not Jack's argument for the locus of the beast is, in fact, leftism. I will attempt to capture some of this through my torturous journey to understand his argument. I will end having solved some of the problems I began with in the paper. Before I launch into this paper, I want to make a few more personal comments. We all do have our unique perspectives on life. None of us has a broad overarching perspective from which to view life. My comments are from my limited experience. For reasons that will become clear as my analysis unfolds, I really do not enjoy typical left-right fisticuffs that have been part of the American scene since before we were a country. Personally, I've found a number of them incredibly painful. As I understand American history, the worst fisticuffs in U.S. history was by far the campaign of 1800. In an election of unsurpassed nastiness, it largely pitted the Federalists against the Anti-Federalists. We were lucky we survived it. Historically in the U.S., I believe that most of the interactions between the left and right have been over social and political issues. It's not unprecedented that religion has played a part, but mostly it's been over social and political issues. And as Jack points out, what constitutes left and right changes over time. The issues that have given rise to positions are often events or social or political perspectives. So it appears to me that these passionate sparring matches are part of our social fabric. My problem with them is there's only two sides, and the proponents of each side claim that there is a clear black and white choice to be made. In my view, it's usually the case that the issues involved in these left-right fisticuffs are complicated and that their choices are not quite as black and white as people want them, make them out to be. Here at Gutenberg, we try to provide a place where all questions and positions can be presented and discussed, not for the purposes of propaganda, but for the purpose of seeking truth. Jack has raised some serious issues that do need to be addressed. So, comfortable or not, I will proceed. I'll begin by examining Jack's argument and points to areas that I admit I'm not tracking or I disagree. Jack believes that American culture appears to be collapsing before his eyes. He wonders what America will look like in the future. Also, as a follower of Jesus, how could he respond? How should he respond? These are incredibly important concerns. I share with Jack the perception that we're witnessing the catastrophic decline of America and that the end seems inevitable without miraculous intervention. Jack centers his attention on the political arena as the sphere of greatest concern. As he sees it, the cause of decline in America is what he terms the beast. The beast can symbolize any satanically inspired opposition to God and his purposes. Jack uses the term beast to describe any such efforts by Satan to oppose God and his purposes anywhere in the world and at any time in the world. So the beast can designate any person, culture, institution, or society anywhere in the world at any time that seeks to thwart and defeat God and his purposes, and that asserts its superiority to God. Jack contends that American society has become a beast in this sense. This beast is the culture of power that increasingly has shaped American culture since about 1860. This satanic power is rooted in seduction, not violence or coercion. At this point, there's one point that I wonder a little about. I've become more unsure where to draw the line between just sinful man and satanic-driven rebellion. However, Jack provides three cultural realities to help demarcate the satanic-driven class. They will be characterized by three cultural realities: membership in a superior class, the emergence of contra-biblicism as an orthodox religion, and the development of propaganda to further that claim. The beast's agenda is to promote religious commitments to a set of beliefs and values that constitute this religion of contra-biblicism. Propaganda's job is to enhance the appeal of contra-biblicism. Up to this point, I'm tracking with Jack, and I believe he's right in his analysis. However, at this point, Jack then claims that this religion of the beast, contra-biblicism, is leftism. Right here, my discomfort meter pegged. I mean, this is something out of Orwell. This is doublespeak. He specifically states that this religion, contra-biblicism, is synonymous with leftism. It's precisely here that I have a couple problems. Jack states, it's important to keep in mind, however, that leftism and contra-biblicism, as I'm using the terms, are exactly synonymous. In other words, Jack is just saying that contra-biblicism and leftism are the same by definition. I take Jack to mean at least the following. These terms have identical characteristics or definitions. They are made up of exactly the same set of people. I have three potential problems with this. As Jack has described them, I don't see at first how they have identical characteristics. First, contra-biblicism. Jack defines this class as defined by explicitly rejecting biblical beliefs and values and replacing them piecemeal with contrary views. The result is an incoherent set of beliefs. But in leftism, he says, the contrary values are Darwin replaces Genesis, Freud replaces a biblical view of man, Marx replaces the biblical account of history, and higher criticism is used to interpret the Bible. My first point is, in contra-biblicism, my picture is someone taking a specific issue like sexuality and saying the Bible teaches X, I believe Y, where X and Y are contraries. They then pick a different biblical perspective issue, like what my response to government should be, and believe something different. That's my picture of contrabiblicism. Because the beliefs and values are selected one at a time and in piecemeal fashion, these contrary beliefs are contrary to Christianity and they result in an incoherent system. That seems to me to be a very different perspective than starting with Darwin, Freud, and Marx. Secondly, I don't see that starting with Darwin, Freud, and Marx results in an incoherent set of beliefs like contrabiblicism. Darwin, Freud, and Marx, after all, are all materialists. It seems to me possible to construct a coherent theory from these three positions. It may be wrong, incomplete, but it seems to me possible that it could be made coherent. I don't see how the emphasis placed on the piecemeal nature of the set of beliefs and the problems of incoherence is identical in the two cases. Moving to my third point, it's hard for me to see the set of people in each group being identical. The two groups appear to me to be doing very different intellectual exercises. It's difficult for me at this point to see the same people doing these very different kinds of projects. As a result, at this point, I don't have a clear picture of who Jack has in mind. Contrabiblicism is a person who, as they go from day-to-day experience, decides piecemeal to reject individual biblical values and beliefs. The other group starts with Darwin, Freud, and Marx. I seem unable to make these classes synonymous. I'm guessing I probably don't have part of this picture right. We all can picture the contrabiblicist. I'll provide an example of a group that I believe fits the second, but not the first. During the 1960s, which by my recollection actually ran from about 1968 to 72, I attended James Madison College, which was a small residence hall college within Michigan State University. As I understand it, James Madison was started by a group of New Deal Democrats to train up the next generation of leftist politicians. They called their perspective the New Left. The faculty was headed by a guy named Herbert Garfinkel, and the only conservative among the early faculty was George Will. I believe George Will's current title is political analyst, but I didn't check that out. Most of the curriculum fits Jack's description of leftism. There was a lot of Marx and classes dealing primarily with civil rights and class conflict. Darwin and Freud were not explicitly taught, but it seemed clear to me that their ideas were more or less implied. But there was also a lot of Nietzsche. So on the surface, it would line up quite well with the content of Jack's description of leftism, but at this point, I can't see how it fits contrabiblicism. Remember, Jack defined contrabiblicism as being characterized by its fragmented content. Contrabiblicism results from the explicit rejection of Christian beliefs and values piecemeal. My difficulty is that at James Madison College, the project was largely to build a coherent political view starting with Marx, Darwin, Freud, and Nietzsche. Thinking back over the curriculum for this new left, as they called it, none of it on the surface was Christian or sympathetic to a Christian worldview. Nor would I say that there was any explicit reference to Christianity at all in any of the content. Would such a program be antithetical to biblical Christianity? Of course. I can't imagine anybody who would deny that. In my experience, I can easily see the James Madison curriculum as leftism, as Jack describes it, but at this point, I find it a little difficult to fit it within the idea of contrabiblicism. I also want to provide some additional content from my James Madison experience. I believe it's necessary content for a later portion of my paper. I went to James Madison College because I'm interested in politics, but only at afar. I can't stand the fisticuff, rough and tumble nature of politics of the left and right. I come from a long line of active leftists in the traditional sense, not in Jack's sense. My great-grandfather was an original homesteader in Michigan, and he served for many years in the Michigan legislature. Since the farm was far from the Capitol, my great-grandfather built a house not far from the Capitol to live in during the legislative sessions. My grandmother and her brothers and sisters were all very active politically. One of my grandmother's sisters was the hostess at the governor's mansion for, I believe, 3 terms for a bachelor governor. All 5 of them lived into their 90s. When I was growing up, they all lived together in the house my grandfather built near the Capitol. They had either never married or they had outlived their spouses. It was an active center within the state for politics. I spent a lot of time there as my grandmother, the only clear Christian believer of the group, took care of me while my mother finished graduate school. Given my background and interest in politics, James Madison was a logical choice. However, it was my experience at James Madison that caused me to abandon leftism that I'd grown up with. As part of the curriculum, we were all required to read and discuss the federal papers over a period of, I believe it was a year. In particular, we spent a lot of time on Federalist Number 10. It was the reading of particularly James Madison that caused me to reject the leftism as Jack has defined it, and the leftism in the traditional sense that I'd grown up with. I found Madison's arguments thoroughly convincing. By this time, my grandmother and her brothers and sisters had died, so I just had to deal with my mother. Because of my rejection of the family values, I wasn't welcome at home, and I think I visited her 3 times during the next 20 years or so. To this day, my mother, who's 92 next week, researches and collects inane and often evil things that the right says and does. They're not just blurbs off talk show radio, but well-researched little items with all the proper context. She doesn't write much anymore, but we talk every 2 weeks, and she will have her list ready for me to explain how I can possibly agree with people like this. This contributes greatly to my discomfort over these issues. Returning now to Jack's argument, in the same paragraph he says, I introduced the term leftism, not because it captures a new and different concept, but because it suggests connections to our experience that contrabiblicism does not. It's not clear what he means, but again, my discomfort meter is pegged. Jack has defined leftism differently from how we normally define it, so how does he want us to draw on our experience? Isn't our experience of leftism, leftism in the more traditional sense, not in his sense? If that's true, I'm sorry that Jack wants us to import parts of leftism as it's traditionally defined. Surely this isn't what Jack's trying to do. I think his point is something like contrabiblicism doesn't conjure up in us a political picture of political groups and political power. Leftism certainly does not conjure up such a picture. What Jack is claiming is that left, as he describes it, has since the 1860s in America, it's developed within the greater American left, and it's been part of the American political landscape. No argument there. That's undeniable. But leftism, as Jack describes it, is a subset of our traditional understanding of leftism. So my problem is I'm not sure what elements of leftism it is we're supposed to conjure up. To summarize the first part of my argument at this point, I'm tracking with Jack and I agree with him until he says that contrabiblicism is leftism. First, I don't think they have exactly the same content, that they're equal and that they're equally piecemeal and that they're made up of the same people. Second, when Jack claims that contrabiblicism equals leftism, in his argument, this is true by definition, and he argues that there's no new content. Yet it seems he wants us to conjure up something else. But what exactly that is, I don't know. I know I'm highly sensitive to these sorts of claims, but I worry about equivocating his definition of leftism somehow with our traditional definition of leftism. Also, such a claim seems really easy to be misconstrued as far as what its purpose is, but I'm guessing I probably don't have it right. Jack then examines the opposition reactions to the left's attack on Christian values. He divides the reaction of the right into two camps, the right and the pseudo-right. This is not usually how we carve up the right. But Jack is certainly not wrong. I find no fault with Jack's analysis here, and I will return to it later in the paper. But for me, this step turned out to be the key to my understanding, I think, what Jack's project actually is. The last item, then, I will discuss in this section, my critique of the elements of Jack's analysis, is in the section entitled, Where Does a Follower of Jesus Fit? First, Jack claims that it's not possible to be a follower of Jesus and a leftist as he has described it. As mentioned previously, this is true by definition, so I don't have a problem, but I do have a nervousness. But I don't think anyone should experience any discomfort over this. That Jack then critiques the notion of the Christian left. As long as one keeps in mind that how Jack has described leftism, I have no problem whatsoever with it. On the top of page 25, Jack argues that if a Christian throws his support behind a leftist agenda, such as justice, environmental stewardship, etc., it calls into question his commitment to biblical truth because this agenda is ultimately rooted in hostility to Jesus. This is a profound insight, and I believe it's true. Christians have not thought well about their participation in things that would be considered leftist agenda. Following that, Jack presents a hypothetical case. If a person is existentially committed to Jesus, how can he throw his support behind a leftist agenda? Of course, I agree with Jack entirely on his point here, but I admit I was uncomfortable for a period of time. Why? I've spent most of my life working in environmental stewardship. Since becoming a Christian, I've been asked, I couldn't tell you how many times, how I can be a Christian and ecologist at the same time. What interests me about this, as the question comes just as frequently from the traditional left as it does from the traditional right. The view of both sides is that the notion of a Christian ecologist is an oxymoron. I think it'd be interesting to sort out the responses given Jack's definition of left and right, but I don't have enough knowledge about the people to make the responses and figure out what they would be. Now, I'll subsequently return back to this, to the main point. Is Jack saying now that I'm a Christian, that I can't continue to work in environmental stewardship because it's part of a leftist agenda against Christianity? No. But what he is saying, if I do so, I need to rethink my foundation and make sure that it's based on actual biblical Christianity in order to do it. This concludes the first part of my paper. I have completed my not so much as of a critique as an exploration of the nuts and bolts of Jack's analysis. At this point, I'm in agreement with him that America's in decline and the future prospects look grim. I agree with his analysis at this point, except where he's equated contrabiblicism with leftism. I still have the problem equivocating the two. I'm puzzled, and I suspect I don't have it right. But at this point, I'm basically in agreement with Jack's argument. Now I'm going to turn to the second portion of the paper, my general critique of Jack's analysis. My first comment is that what Jack has done is to examine the notion of the political left and right through the eyes of a biblically-based Christian. This analysis is insightful, rigorous, stimulating, and of course what we all ought to be doing with all aspects of life. Above all, I believe it's true, and I can't thank Jack more for his analysis. By definition, it will be an analysis that's foreign to the analysis rooted in our culture. It's hard work for me to separate his analysis from our traditional analysis at points just because the traditional analysis of left and right is so deeply rooted in us as Americans. But we all ought to work at this. Second, I think that Jack is right. America is in profound trouble, and the future prospects don't look promising. Why do I think this? I guess I have to say, because I'm an old guy, I've experienced what to me feels like a different America. Third, while at the moment I have qualms about his argument that leftism and contrabiblicism are the same, I believe he's identified a group that is at least a portion of the cause of the beast and a decline of America. Fourth, do I believe that Jack is right about the left as he defined it being the primary power of the beast? At this point, I'm not sure. Tuesday night, on the way home from our staff meeting where we decided the order of which we were all going to talk and what we were going to talk about, I had an epiphany. I would now like to return to Jack's claim that contrabiblicism equals leftism and his analysis of the right. I believe I didn't get it earlier. I still have some loose ends, but here's my revised understanding. I will now give an example of leftism as Jack defined it. I believe that laissez-faire capitalism is an example of leftism. I will define laissez-faire capitalism not as it's technically defined, but how it's commonly understood. My definition of laissez-faire capitalism is it's capitalism unfettered by government or morality. By my definition, laissez-faire capitalists would argue that Adam Smith's invisible hand goes like this. Through each individual's pursuit of their selfish interest, by the miraculous hand of God, all things will work together for good. Let me give you an example that will provide the context for then my analysis of laissez-faire capitalism being leftist. When the early English settlers landed in North America, one of the things they immediately noticed was the virtually limitless stands of white pine. Although the settlers didn't know it earlier, it would be the case that white pine would drive the timber industry in North America for the next 200 years. It was worth more than the California gold rush. So what's the big deal about white pine? At first, white pine was immediately recognized as superior mast wood for sailing ships. The British Crown identified the King's Stand. This was the primary reason that the British ruled the sea. In 1774, the colonists stopped the shipping of white pine to England. The first flag of the colonies was the white pine flag. This resulted in the British having to splice short pieces of wood together to form the masts on their sailing ships. Their ships no longer could maneuver like American ships. Not to take anything away from John Paul Jones, when he sailed the Ranger out of Portsmouth, Maine, the ship had the three largest masts of white pine that ever went to sea. The British could not come close to the maneuverability of the Ranger. He scored major victories. But by 1960s, the white pine was gone in New England. The timber barons then moved through Michigan, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. When it came to Michigan, they cut the majority of white pine in the state in about 30 years. They left the land in slash, which started forest fires unprecedented in their size and intensity. It burned hundreds of square miles. It burned cities. No one knows how many people died. One fire in northern Wisconsin killed more people than were killed in the Great Chicago Fire that started the same day. These fires ruined most of the land in the areas so that white pine no longer even grew. I'll present only one piece of evidence to claim that this was not sustainable harvest. In the early 1900s, Old Ironside, veteran of the War of 1812, needed new masts. Nowhere in North America were there three white pines left. They had to be replaced by Douglas fir. Go look. But this is only the tip of the iceberg. They harvested the trees by cutting them and driving them down the streams. They cleared the streams of downed timber and dynamited the jams out that occurred. In this process, a dominant salmonid in the region went extinct. I saw my first Michigan grayling at the age of 6 in a museum. What would it have been like to have seen a grayling and to have caught one? That experience was removed from all people born before 1930, when the last one died in the hands of scientists trying to save it. Now returning to laissez-faire capitalism. Remember, what constitutes contra-biblicism is three things: the existence of a superior class, construction of a new religion opposed to biblical Christianity, and the development of propaganda to further the religion. Firstly, is this group a superior group? I would say, without question. But to be a member of it isn't exactly the same. This is one of those loose ends I'm going to have at the end. It's not just a matter of believing the right thing in this case. In this case, it takes dollars. But without question, they have influence far beyond just their numbers. Now to the contra-biblicism. It is an orthodox religion built on views contrary to the Bible. In laissez-faire capitalism, economic activity is unfettered by government or morality, as I have defined it. It's clearly unbiblical. The Bible establishes that there is a morality when it comes to economic activity. While there's not a lot of biblical passages dealing with this issue, I think that there are more than enough to make my point. First, in the Genesis account, during the first 5 days, God created the universe and all the plants and animals and called them good. Man is to have dominion over the animals. We are responsible for them. Then at the fall, notice that not only does man fall, but God curses the rest of the created order. Next, Noah saved a remnant, not only of human beings, but also the animal kingdom as well. And there are a few passages in the law as we go through it. One, don't create fields all the way to your fence row, your dividing line. What's the principle behind that sort of a law? Economic efficiency is not the highest good. There's another piece of the law. When you come upon a bird with young, you can take the young, but not the mother, so it goes well with you. Seems to me a principle built on morality. And in Romans, Paul argues in chapter 8 that all nature will be redeemed, not just man. Clearly in Christianity, redemption is to be experienced by all creation, not just man. Lastly, I'd like to read just part of a short passage from the end of Job. Basically, God is speaking about the nature of his power primarily, who he is, and the nature of his, and as I said, the nature of his power. But also, what I'm interested in here is beyond just the interest in who God is and what's his power, what is God's emotional relationship to what he has created? Do you know the time the mountain goats give birth? Do you observe the calving of the deer? Can you count the months they fulfill? Do you know the time that they give birth? They kneel down, they bring forth their young, they get rid of their labor pains. Their offspring becomes strong, they grow up in the open field. They leave and do not return. Who sent out the wild donkey free? Who loosed the bonds of the swift donkey? To whom I gave the wilderness for a home and the salt land for his dwelling place. He scorns the tumult of the city. The shouting of the driver he does not hear. He explores the mountains for his pasture and seeks after every green thing. Will the wild ox consent to serve you, or will he spend the night at your manger? Can you bind the wild ox in a furrow with rope, or will he harrow the valleys after you? Will you trust him because his strength is great and leave your labor to him? Will you have faith in him that he will return your grain and gather it from your threshing floor? The ostrich's wings flap joyously with the pinion and plumage of love, for she abandons her eggs to the earth and warms them in the dust. And she forgets that a foot may crush them, or that a wild animal may trample them. She treats her young cruelly as if they were not hers. Though her labor be in vain, she is unconcerned. because God has made her forget wisdom. He has not given her a share of understanding. When she lifts herself on high, she laughs at the horse and its rider. Do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe the neck with a mane? Do you make him leave like a locust? His majestic snorting is terrible. He paws the valley and rejoices in his strength. I'm going to skip the rest of that short section. Is it your understanding that the hawk soars and stretches his wings towards the south? Is it at your command that the eagle mounts up and makes his nest on high? On the cliff he dwells, and the ledges, and on rocky crag and inaccessible places. From there he spies out his food. His eyes see it from all afar. His young ones also suck up blood, and where the slain are there, he is. Then God asks Job some questions. I want to go to chapter 41 now. Can you draw out the Leviathan with a fish hook? Who can open the doors of his face around his teeth? There is terror. His strong scales are his pride. Shut up as with a tight seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They're joined to one another. They clasp each other and can't be separated. His sneezes flash forth light. His eyes are like the eyelids of morning. Out of his mouth goes burning torches. Sparks of fire leap forth. Out of his nostrils smoke comes forth. I'll stop there. But the question I want to ask with those passages is not just God is clearly pointing that he created all those animals. He described them as good. And it seems to me in those passages, there's a sense of love and emotion towards the creation he has created. Clearly in this section, Job is primarily dealing with God's power, but notice his description of the animals. God delights in them. Here's what I think he might have written about the Michigan grayling. He was one of the most beautiful of all the salmonids, especially with his large dorsal fin that had more colors in it than a rainbow, especially underwater. He is a creature that will only be found in very cold, perfectly clear water. The grayling does not tolerate any mismanagement of the drainage basin. He's your canary in the mine. Take care of him, and he'll take care of you, of the land. I think that this brief sketch is enough to establish that there is a Christian morality with regard to economics. Laissez-faire economics argues for unfettered economic activity, just as any other leftist agenda. Returning now to laissez-faire capitalism, I'll move to the third criteria, propaganda. It's not hard to describe the propaganda that this group uses. In this view, laissez-faire capitalists, if there is no government regulation or any other incumbent, the profit motive will lead to sustainable environmental stewardship. Didn't work for the white pine. Didn't work for the Michigan grayling. It's not working for Pacific salmon, as more than half of them are now on the endangered species list. It's never worked anywhere dealing with any natural resources. It's pure propaganda. Clearly, a laissez-faire leftist, as Jacks described him, and also Adam Smith argued against laissez-faire capitalism as I described it. I'll make a long argument short. He knew the philosophy of the laissez-faire capitalists. Adam Smith had visited them. In his 1,038-page book, the term laissez-faire never occurs once. And in it, there's a long chapter on the expenses that the sovereign or commonwealth ought to expend. In Adam Smith's perspective, the role of government needs to play a role in defense, justice, public works, and public institutions. Clearly, Adam Smith was not a laissez-faire capitalist. To be fair, he did see the best government as one that had a limited role in the market economy, but it was not no role. Earlier, Jack raised the issue that committed Christians ought not to be involved in leftist agenda. I believe that this is an example of the leftist agenda, as Jack has described it, no less than environmental stewardship is. No Bible-believing Christian should be supporting leftist agendas. I agree with Jack. But I'm not finished. I now want to examine Adam Smith's economics. In order to understand Adam Smith's project, we need to view his life's work. In Adam Smith's mind, his project consisted of three works. First, the moral sentiments. This laid the moral foundation for the other two works. The second was The Wealth of Nations, dealing with economics. The third was an unfinished work on law of society. In order to understand what Adam Smith is saying in economics, we need to understand the moral foundation he laid for it. In it, Smith argues that the invisible hand was not based on selfishness, but prudence. His example was the butcher. The butcher will view a customer from a long-term perspective. He doesn't want their business only today, but over the long run. His business depends on it. That's the basis of the win-win situation in Adam Smith's perspective. This is the foundation of wealth in his view. But is Adam Smith's perspective based on a biblical content? No, his account is just as contra-biblical and as much a leftist account as that of the laissez-faire economist. Start reading The Moral Sentiments. It's based on David Hume's philosophy, which is probably the most anti-biblical of any philosophy at the time. And Smith claims that he's giving a naturalistic account to account for the morals of economics. Adam Smith's economics is another example of a leftist agenda. No committed Christian should give any support to a leftist agenda. Now, don't misunderstand my argument here. I think biblical Christianity is coherent with a capitalistic account, but my claim is it will not be Adam Smith's account. So how would I describe this economic scenario from a historical perspective? In the 1860s, laissez-faire capitalism began to gain power. Their goal was to separate morals from economics. They did it by devising corporations. Corporations are entities, according to law. They're the responsible parties. This limited the risk of stockholders and to what they had invested. A number of Superfund sites in the U.S. represents corporations that dissolved unless the damage they caused to the public. Second, corporate structure diffuses the responsibility for actions such that no one is responsible, not the shareholders, not the managers, not the board. Adam Smith warned us about that problem. In the last 20 years, corporate structure has become global to the point where it's no longer limited by the laws of any countries. When the seventh beast comes, as Jack describes, he will be the most powerful king to date. He must harness the world's economic resources for his power. It is most convenient if the majority of the world's resources are held by a few corporations in which morals have been totally excluded from economic activity. No situation could better serve him to gain and utilize the economic resources of the world. But when does this power become satanic in nature? I don't know for sure, but it clearly does at some point. However, I will present one component of the beast now that I originally thought was outside left and right. I thought this was my ace, but now I think I'm wrong. My argument will be brief here. About 500 years ago, Francis Bacon started a project which has now turned the Enlightenment. The goal of this project was through science we would harness and control nature, use it for our purposes to solve all the human problems on the planet. The goal was that through science, we will harness nature to solve all our human problems. This project has evolved and grown over the centuries. If it was not anti-biblical at the start, it soon became so. Today, it's no longer characterized by Bacon's conception. Today, they have tools such as genetic engineering that'll enable us to remake nature in our image or anything else that we want. Not only nature, but human beings as well. Through genetic engineering, we can make humans into our conception of what they should be. This is a total abandonment of God's creation. This is totally contra-biblicism. Again, I'll use Jack's three cultural realities. Science consists of a small number of a superior class. Their view is clearly contra-biblical, and they're using propaganda to further their goal. Therefore, they too are leftists. I think I'm finally beginning to get what Jack's project was. Anyone who's not a Bible-believing Christian is a leftist by definition. That clears up who's left. Therefore, it's the case by definition that the power of the beast is the left. Originally, my idea was that there were a number of things like science that would be outside of Jack's analysis. And here was my thought experiment that I thought I could use to prove it. Take the group that Jack has defined as leftists and beam them to another planet. Now ask the question, what will be the trajectory of America? Only Christians are left. It seems to me that I'm finally getting Jack's picture. Second, the piecemeal nature that Jack described that I had a lot of difficulty with, what he's actually referring to isn't individual choices, but the fact that now the left is comprised of many factions that were historically on the right. That's the piecemeal nature of what Jack has proposed. This adds greatly to incoherence. But in the end, all leftists, as Jack has defined them, would all accept Darwin, Freud, and Marx to try to build a coherent system from. So my problem of seeing contrabiblicism and leftism are greatly diminished. Also, the phrase about leftism introducing concepts familiar to our experience, I think I can now get that too. Jack could have argued that contrabiblicism is rightism and called a biblical view leftism. But we normally call the right the one that's trying to save conservative values. I think that was his point. It's interesting. For me, had Jack said contrabiblicism was rightism, I'd have gotten his analysis immediately, given my history and my journey. In the past, I've described these issues as errors of the left and errors of the right. Jack's analysis makes the argument much clearer from a biblical perspective. You're either a Christian or you're a leftist, by definition. There's still a few loose ends for me. Like some of the factions within leftism use more coercion than seduction. But these sorts of things probably just loose ends that are trivial and minor. In conclusion, Jack has presented us with an interesting, rigorous, profound analysis of the politics of our present time constructed through the lens of biblical Christianity. Mostly I'm still working through the ideas. I think I'm finally getting a handle on his argument. In the end, the left is the cause of the beast, by definition. If Jack beamed these people up, as he's defined leftists, all that would be left on the planet were Bible-believing Christians. If this is the case, it is clearly true that the trajectory of America would probably be different. Jack's analysis also helped me understand my James Madison experience better. My rejection of the left for Madison, in some sense, signaled that God was at work in my life. I think there's one more element of Jack's argument that bears thinking about. I think that it's a very useful framework here, but it certainly wouldn't fly outside at all. If this is not a reflection in the change America's talking about, I don't know what is. Even the 60s, I think you could have talked about Jack's proposal outside. The Jesus movement suggests that that was probably true, where today it wouldn't pass a laugh test outside this building. That's my perception. So is it true? Could it get any traction at all with the intellectual gurus of our current culture? I have my doubts. I actually wish that I was wrong. Speaking of being wrong, Jack has proven me wrong again. I believe that all left-right tussles and conceptions of reality were not as black and white as any of the proponents think. Jack's argument here looks pretty black and white to me, and my discomfort level is zero. I want to ask the first question. I want to ask Jack if I was making any progress in understanding this picture. It was a tortured journey.
Okay, so let's get Jack's thumbs up on the microphone there. All right. Charlie, I'm a guy, I like black and white. I mean, I sort of function with black and white, and I'm sure a lot of it is a personality thing that I just like to figure out exactly where I stand so I can act on it. And so often when I'm talking with you, I find myself very challenged in very good ways, oftentimes ways that my head kind of hurts. And that's one of the things I appreciate most about you. But let me ask about and ask you to elaborate a little bit on some of the things that you were talking about, specifically with regard to capitalism. And I don't know if we're on the same page, on different pages. Just yesterday, I was listening to a discussion that Milton Friedman was having, and he was asked a question about laissez-faire capitalism, asked the question, is there any role for government? And he said, well, of course there is. The role for government is if a third party is wronged, well, then that's the role for government. And for me, that was like, well, yeah, light goes on, because that's the biblical model. The role of government is to act when evildoers are doing evil. That's the role of government. So, or a role of government. So that made a lot of sense to me. So given your examples, I guess what I'm trying to think through is there any, and I'm thinking of the Michigan grayling, of the grayling, of the white pine, of the Pacific salmon. Granted, we should not, as keepers of God's creation, we should not gratuitously and wantonly slaughter things, whether it's the white pine, the grayling, the salmon. But where is that balance? And in the examples you used, I can certainly see how when the white pine forests are decimated and fields are left so that eventually harm is done to others because of the actions of those who harvested the white pine, I can certainly see a reason for stepping in there. Or when the streams are destroyed and harm is done to others because of something like that. But is there, are you saying that capitalism, are you saying there's inherent value, for example, in the white pine as a white pine, that even if the last one is harvested to meet the needs of a human, that would still be wrong? I don't know if my question is clear. Are there...
I think I'm understanding your question. Is there ever a case where it would be absolutely immoral to take the last of something? I don't think so. So I don't think that's the imperative. But let me answer the first part of it, because I think this will get at the first part of what I heard you saying. I started a project 30 years ago here in the Coast Range. The question was, if we take a watershed, it's mixed ownership. Some of it was public land and wilderness. About a third of it was an industrial timber farm. And part of it is a road corridor. My question was, how well, if we're actually talking to each other and working together, how well can we do at managing all those resources? And I came to the conclusion we can do really pretty darn good. Cases like this. In 1996, we had a major storm. We got all kinds of landslides, and some streams were destroyed that had salmon in them. Well, the timber companies still had to take a cutout to pay their bills. But by telling them, well, look, these streams are already trashed. They're not coming back. They're not going to produce salmon for 20 or 30 years. Take your cut out of those basins. We've got two or three basins over here where there wasn't any landslides. They're producing salmon now. Don't cut those, because that would increase the risk to those fish. Those conversations go a long way to fixing the problem. But one of the primary things is the industrial logger that I started working in this project in the Coast Range with, as soon as it got out what he was doing, he was fired, because the corporations did not want to work in any sense with these people. He got fired. So there's a lot of things that we could be doing a lot better, but they aren't happening because it's not in the best interest of short-term profits. Secondly, at a point in time in the project, the industrial timberland was owned by a state pension fund. I won't name the state, but you can probably guess it. Who were those pension funds? School teachers, retired government workers, all of that. They were demanding 8% yield on that property. Trees grow at 6%. Do the math. How is that even possible? You got to harvest them faster than they grow. In other words, the trees on that land during their ownership got smaller and smaller and smaller. So I don't know. Am I getting at the answer to the question you want? But, well, and there's a third piece. I think with regard to economics, I haven't completely gone back and done it myself. I'm not primarily an economist, but I'm recognizing that I think if we do it right, if we think about it right, economics and ecology are really part of the same thing. They're the same exercise. Ecology is just the natural economy that God gave us to work with. We put an industrial economy on top of it. So economics is really those two things together. Now, I've done the latter, but I haven't done the industrial economics part of that. But here's how I would start in thinking about a biblical view. I mean, I'd start with the Bible. I'd start with what are the principles laid out in it as far as how we ought to manage? What kind of status does nature have? Does God indicate that we're required to protect all species? I don't see that that's true. But by the same token, I think at judgment, we are going to get held accountable for how we took care of the created order. That is going to be part of the judgment. So I think what we need to do is start with biblical principles, and then we can look at stuff like Adam Smith's. I think Adam Smith says a lot of things that are true to nature, true to reality, fit absolutely perfectly well with the Bible. But there's a number of things in there and a number of assumptions Adam Smith made that are contra-biblicism, pure and simple. We need to go through and sort those out and work that project out. I've not done it, so I can't give you any more explicit answers. But anyway, all of that, am I getting at the questions you asked?
That's very, very helpful. I guess that in the best of all possible, how far is it supposed to be? In the best of all possible worlds, individuals and corporations would behave morally. And that they would be rewarded, if you will, for moral behavior and punished for immoral behavior, corporations mm-hmm. as well. And that would then lead to a better functioning economy, ecology, all those sorts of things.
Yes, there is one to Adam Smith's argument against joint stock corporations, I think, that's also biblical. He wasn't sure joint stock corporations were, he wouldn't put it in these terms, but he didn't like joint stock corporations at all. Why? The board, for instance, has no stake in the outcome. It's neither here nor there whether they, in other words, they don't have money invested in it. It's separate. They're just responsible for the direction of it. If they make wrong decisions, it's not really their hides that take it. They don't have money invested. So, but he argued that the very structure of it is essentially diffusing the responsibility for any action. So if a corporation does something, who's to blame? Are the shareholders? I mean, is it the board? Is it the president? Is it middle level? And so look what happens. A corporation does something heedlessly evil. They find a couple people somewhere in the structure, send them to jail for a little while, and that's the end of it. But there's a sense in which that whole structure seems to me to have to be pushing towards an unbiblical view. The biblical view was you ought to be responsible for your decisions. That's how economics ought to be based. Any activity in economics you would propose that's going to limit your responsibility for your actions, I'd argue, is unbiblical.
Of course, now we're in a situation where our government allows corporations to not be responsible by bailing them out by by trying to
absolutely.
And then I guess back to, and I'll let somebody else have the microphone. My only other question, thought, and I think I know what you'll say about this, but with regard to ecology, is it seems to me as though, if you will, on the left, if we can generalize in such broad general terms, nature becomes more important than humans, oftentimes. And that, to me, is just a fundamentally unbiblical position. Do you have a thought about that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, just a short comment, and that is I look at the biblical account, what I see, the most useful thing I read, and it's really the only Christian that I'm aware of that's actually really done some really good work on this issue, and not too surprisingly, is Francis Schaeffer. He was responding to an article in, I forgot which scientific journal it was in, but the argument was being made that Buddhists treat nature better than Christians do. And anyway, so the guy made the argument, published it in his scientific journal, and the reason that Francis Schaeffer wrote his book, Pollution and the Death of Man, was to say, well, I mean, actual matter of fact, that may be true, but that isn't actually the Christian position. Because, so, are you absolutely right? You're absolutely right about the left, about a lot of parts of the left. But the other thing I do want to caution you, there's an awful lot of people like me who their greatest impediment, and it was mine for half my life, is Christians. All I heard was the right-hand side of Christianity. All I heard was the economic arguments. I mean, even back to when I was running the family farm, you're not farming efficiently. I mean, you got the biggest fence rows of anybody in the county because you're raising pheasants and deer. Well, I look at that now. That wasn't biblical. Their perspective wasn't biblical. Now, if there came a time where we needed something for our family, I would have narrowed those fence rows and farmed. But the point was, that was part of, I saw it as part of my mandate. And there's a lot of people like me that see that, and they don't see any Christians saying anything about what the right says. They don't criticize it at all. And there are times where that's sometimes my reaction to things I'll hear Jack say, like the paper. I mean, there was that bit about biblical stewardship in it, like, you know, biblical stewardshipism is a left issue. But see, I didn't hear the other side exactly. Yeah, but so is laissez-faire capitalism and Adam Smith capitalism. That's just as much. Contra-biblicism is environmental stewardship. That's what I never heard. With the exception of Francis Schaeffer, that's about the only voice I've ever heard. So, you know, I'm not sure I'm answering your question.
No, you've
exactly
answered it, and you've hit on that's the reason I like hanging around with people around here, is to be exposed to those different views and to have a chance to work those things through.
Well, there was a long period in my life that essentially, you know, that if the Christianity I was being taught that this is what Christianity is, my response is I couldn't love that kind of God. There is no way. Sorry if I didn't get all your...
So here's my question, Charlie. I'm actually a little bit cutting my own throat here and asking this question because I'm talking tomorrow morning. And I have been working on trying to... I have several issues with what Jack has said in his paper. And one of them relates to this left-right stuff that you've just been talking about. And so in asking you to clarify what you're saying and therefore kind of inviting Jack to clarify this whole thing, I may be eliminating my entire... portion of my talk, and then I don't know what I'm going to do. But it seems like it might be an opportune time. So let me. I feel like you've let Jack off the hook too easily here. So I'd like you to repeat back what I've heard you say, and then tell me how you're thinking about this. Okay, I understand your first point to be here's what I'm hearing from you, that your discomfort has diminished as you have come to terms with the fact that, okay, Jack has taken the word leftist and defined it as, okay, contrabiblicism, leftism, they're the same thing. So what we associate with the word left is not what we should be thinking when we hear Jack saying this stuff, at least sort of not what we're supposed to be thinking, because... For instance, I mean, and we can certainly see in the paper in one direction, Jack, he does a similar thing to what you did with laissez-faire capitalism. I mean, he's acknowledging that a Tea Party person might be leftist, or a patriot, right-wing patriot might be leftist, or a libertarian might be leftist, in the sense that if they're pursuing things not... because it is a defense and pursuit of biblical truth, but just some sort of a commitment to some idea on the right, then Jack has that part where he's saying, so, if we take the word leftist and define it as everything that is contra-biblical, and right is everything that is not contra-biblical, then as long as we're consistent in the way that we use the terms, then there's no problem, because kind of by definition, sure, I could have used left-handed and right-handed too. I mean, I could have said that left-handed is the same as contra-biblical and right-handed is the same as biblical. And so then I would have to say, you know, things like, you're right-handed, but you don't believe in the Bible, so you're really left-handed. In the way I'm using my terms, that would be fine. And it seems to me that what I'm hearing you saying is that you're granting Jack, he can use his terms that way. That's the way he means left and right in this case. And so, sure, I mean, contra-biblicism is a force that is bad in America. So leftism is a force that is bad in America, because leftism is identical with contra-biblicism as the terms are being used. So it seemed like you were letting Jack do that, but I don't understand why you're still not uncomfortable, because in the stuff that you went on to say, it seems like what you're saying is, if we look at the reality of left and right, that you might have just as much problem with things on the right as you might have with things on the left in terms of their relationship to biblical truth and that sort of thing. So the question is it fair to use the word left to define as a way of describing the contra-biblical, with the sort of implication that it is largely the left-hand side of the political equation that is against God and not the right? It seems to me like you would not accept that second statement, but you're letting Jack use his language that way. So am I understanding you? And then I'd sort of like to hear Jack respond to that stuff too.
All right. Well, to begin with, my torturous track was in large part due to the problem you identified, is just given that I'm an American in this culture and given my history, I'm going to hear left-right in the traditional sense. So that was my problem, a large part of my problem. But first recognize left and right have been defined any number of ways by our culture over time as it is. I mean, it's a moving, left and right is always been a moving target, and I think everybody recognizes that. Why I'm willing to grant Jack his definitions is what he was proposing. Here's my understanding. What Jack is doing is coming to the issues that we would, in general, and the political issues of left, right, power, how are these coalitions put together. And why I want to grant it to Jack is it seems to me he was saying, okay, well, let's look at that from a biblical perspective. Let's do the analysis through the lens of a Christian. Well, there's only two categories. And in that sense, he's doing a particular analysis, and so he's free to define the terms within his analysis, within that lens, and he has to. I mean, you have to grant him that, is that's the project. As a Christian, he's looking at this issue and saying, here's how I think it really ought to look. Now, The problem, as I see it, is just contra-biblicism is leftism. Take that out on the street for 5 minutes, and it's going nowhere. And in fact, you know, as I say, all my worst fears can be manifested with trying to take that message outside in a context where there is no interest in even wanting to hear how somebody could possibly say that and mean anything intelligent at all. So I'm fine with it here. That's why I don't have any discomfort here. But yeah, if I wandered over to the philosophy department and said, hey, a number of people's discomfort meter would peg. So that's why I'm willing to grant Jack the ability to do that, because it seemed to me his project was, well, as a Christian, how do I think about this stuff? And I'm saying, I think he got it right. Where how I was doing it in the past, I would accept the traditional definitions of left and right, and I would say, now on the left side over here, there are those leftists that, you know, have this agenda that are Marxist, and, you know, I mean, they're pushing that agenda. But there's also a bunch of people, they're not really. And, I mean, you know, there's some Christians over there. And the same on the right is, it's a mixed bag. I'm willing to say, and my analysis was, and I've done this many times, is here's what I see as the errors on the left, and here's what I see as the errors on the right. For me, that's a way to communicate it outside. But in here, I'm perfectly comfortable, and I think Jack's framework is a better framework than the one I was using for in here. I think Jack's very point of why we're in trouble. He can't take that framework out, and my cynicism is here, he couldn't take that framework outside this outside very small group of people and get anywhere. And so, if I answered your question?
That's all right. I don't think I entirely understand. I guess I haven't yet myself arrived at the perspective that that's a particularly helpful way to talk about it amongst ourselves here either. But
so why not just use the terms biblical and anti-biblical? Considering that there's this cultural usage of left and right, why are we allowing the kind of like cultural cached terms that are so loaded? Why are we defaulting to use those instead of biblical, anti-biblical? And either one of that's a question for either one of you guys.
See if I can. I have several points, and see if I can keep them all in mind. Yeah, I mean that's why I started. That's where I started. Contra-biblical is the most apt title to really describe it. And Charlie is absolutely right that it's. I'm looking at it through the lenses of a biblical follower of Jesus. I want to analyze our culture that way. Why? Because the other way of analyzing it is already unbiblical. I mean, our categories of left and right that we normally and typically work with is already prejudiced against what everything we believe as Christians. So why should I allow them to impose their categories on me? In other words, I really do think that history is being driven by the spiritual realities, not by the economic, political, and philosophical realities. People can do all kinds of different things philosophically, politically, economically, have different beliefs, and all of them are enemies of God. None of them are starting from premises that have to be the starting point for me as a Bible-believing Christian. So, yes, this is very internal. I am, in fact, if you remember my opening paragraph, I'm writing to people who agree with me in biblical authority and are Bible-believing followers of Jesus. I think I, too, would take a different tack if I were having to take this outside. So I start off biblical and anti-biblical, or what I called contra-biblical. But one part that I think you missed in what I was saying when I say contra-biblicism just is leftism, the context for that is I've maintained that contra-biblicism is the orthodox religion of the superior class. I think leftism, and here's why I introduced the term leftism, is because it is Freud, Marx, Nietzsche, biblical criticism, those are the people that find acceptance by the superior class, and the superior class is wanting to impose those beliefs on us in fragmented form, not coherent form, but in fragmentary form. We take a little from Nietzsche, a little from Marx, a little here, a little there, and they want to cram it down our throats. You believe this, or you're an idiot. You believe this, or you're an ignorant hick. And those happen to be, and remember I said it's a historical accident. It wouldn't have had to have been this way. But as it happens in Western civilization, the dominant religion, the superior religion, the orthodox religion of the superior class, is a form of economic, social, political left. That notice that I think your analysis of laissez-faire capitalism, the way you've defined it, is exactly right. I would call that on the left as well. But notice, you can't get any points in the superior class by being a laissez-faire capitalist. That's a faction. That's a dissenting voice within the moral, intellectual, social class of the superior class in this country. So that's why I called it leftism, is to describe what I think is the historical reality that as it happened. I mean, is it really any secret to go to the University of Oregon? You're going to get any points by being conservative politically? I mean, the academic environment enforces like crazy allegiance to the left-wing kinds of issues, topics, agenda, and so on. And just a footnote, I have nothing but the greatest admiration for Charlie, and he's taught me a lot about especially environmental stewardship, and I agree with him completely. It's vandalism. It is godless vandalism to take God's creation and just mess with it and destroy it just because we can. And that's not my knee-jerk response, but Charlie has done a good job of persuading me how really godless that is. So that should be part of a biblical perspective as well. But I really appreciate what Charlie said, but it's not an absolute value. If it comes to saving a human being or saving a tree, we got to save a human being. I mean, I can't imagine that would happen. But. So in my collection of, I had a collection there in that footnote where I included environmental stewardship. I don't remember what else I included. But notice the things that on that list get points toward putting you in the superior class. There are a lot of other things that would be biblical causes that you could take up where you are helping people, you are loving people, you are loving your neighbor, but they're not hip and cool and groovy, and you're not going to get any points with the superior class. I went online to try to see what kinds of groups are active in combating the human trafficking, and I couldn't tell. But it wouldn't surprise me if most of them are Christian and not leftist. Well, surely that ought to be just as valuable as any other cause that we can be involved in. But some of them get status and some of them don't. And who decides? The popular vote of the superior class. It's not that I'm against economic stewardship. It just so happens that Charlie's passion overlaps with something that would get him points in the superior class if he wanted it, but he doesn't.
Okay, I'm going to try to make sense. So I think, Charlie, I shared your discomfort with the very specific point that Jack made. If someone endorses a traditionally liberal position, it should give us pause with respect to considering them existentially committed to Christ. I mean, you mentioned that he says something like that. Is that... And that was, it made you uncomfortable, right? He says that in the paper. Okay.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The point is Jack poses hypothetically, if you're committed to Christ, how can you essentially encourage further a leftist agenda in environmental stewardship, for instance? So does that clear it up, or?
Well, I mean,
Yeah, but the point was, well, go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, well, so, I'm sorry. So it seems that they're functioning, or you guys have this kind of holism kind of notion, right? So let me explain what I mean. What will make someone a leftist in Jack's sense, let's say we look at someone and they're an environmentalist. They would be leftist in Jack's sense if they're an environmentalist because they see that the Bible teaches that man has dominion over nature and they reject that. The Bible teaches that, I don't like it, therefore I'm an environmentalist, right? That would be leftist sub J for Jack.
Could be, yeah.
Okay. Now, leftist sub like C for Charlie would be, I see that God values nature and therefore I'm an environmentalist, and that's good. That's not leftist sub J for Jack, but that's leftist sub T for like traditional. Sorry, mm-hmm. I'm making categories here.
Yeah, I think I'm following them, yeah.
Okay. Now, I'm trying to piece together why we would endorse the notion that someone throwing their support behind a traditionally leftist cause should give us pause with respect to treating them as an existentially committed Christian. I think that would make sense only if we accept kind of a statistical argument, right? That statistically speaking, most people who are environmentalists in America as just a matter of historical accident because they are leftists in the contra-biblicist sense. Is that the basis of that argument?
Well, that isn't my basis for the argument. I'll let Jack answer it in his case. My difference, I'll come back to when people in the left, especially people in environmental and ecological sorts of circles, when they find out I'm a Christian, when they ask the question, how can you be a Christian and an ecologist at the same time, where is it they're coming from? Where they're coming from, well, Christianity is the enemy. I mean, because these are the people doing all the bad stuff to the natural resources. So in their mind, Christians are explicitly the enemy. Now, but there's a sense in which they're the enemy in a deep philosophical sense. In other words, their philosophical beliefs that are driving their understanding of why nature is important, we might have the same emotional response looking at the same thing, but our emotional response is actually very different. I mean, I've always been very emotional about this, but my response is actually different now than it was before. I mean, it's rooted in a different sort of perspective. That's the issue for me, is, and that's the challenge of, I've always found that the challenge is then there's the perception, well, you're doing this thing and it's cool and you're doing it because it's cool and, you know, in that versus a different, whole different reason for doing it. So, for example, I'll give you an example, and hopefully I'm not offending anyone in here, but one group of people I have probably the greatest discomfort with or catch and release fly fishermen. Because, see, I think that's the most unbiblical thing I can imagine. And so any environmentalism that came out of the 60s or catch and release fly fishing and stuff, to me, that is worse than... I mean, that is just so far... That reduces fish to nothing more than hedonism. It's just your only purpose for fish is to enjoy the pleasure of catching them. That's the purpose of a fish. And that couldn't be farther from what would motivate me. So, you know, a lot of people, just given that I travel the circle, you know, that circle a lot, the perception is, well, I probably agree with a lot of what they say. The truth of the matter is, 60s-type environmentalists, I have more trouble interacting with them than virtually anybody else on the planet. And it's always been that way. Because it's just rooted in a whole different thing. So is that answering your question?
Well, I'm not really sure what my question was, but maybe. But
well, I thought I knew, but...
Yeah, well, you're in better shape than I am then. So let me... But I think you touched on something. So perhaps there's a generational difference. I think like I don't have the same categories for understanding kind of the way the culture is set up because I'm like 2 years old. So, you know. But my response to Jack's point, and then you kind of... I think I agree with Ron that you cut him a little bit too much slack. But is... So... Why is it not that when I see someone, for example, committed to, say, church planting, because I know that they're not coming from a biblical perspective, that I should just, from my experience, most people committed to this notion of church planting, even though it's ostensibly a Christian kind of thing, in my experience, they don't really care about what the Bible has to say. They care about something else. So why is it that when I look at the traditional leftist positions, it should give me pause, but it's not the case when I look at something like, oh, this person's committed to church planting, therefore it should give me pause with respect to thinking of them as an existentially committed Christian. That's kind of where I was going. I don't know if that is coherent or sensible, but that's kind of...
No, that's a great question. This paper is focused on a very, very specific analysis. If most or some of you know that throughout most of my career, it's the church planting types that I have been critical about for my whole career. Once I got a brain, let's put it that way. So, no, I think we should be just as critical about that. Really? Is that what we're going to do, is spread more of Christendom rather than biblical followers of Jesus? So we should be highly critical of them. But the left is going to be critical of them too, right? I mean, they're imperialists. They are evil, nasty, monster Christians out there. Well, in a sense, they're right. But for different reasons, I think, than they think. Because they would be just as, call me a monster as well, for my belief in the Bible and in Jesus. So, yes, we should be as critical of them. And one thing that's not clear, I mean, it was just, I didn't think I had to be clear because it was a footnote. But in that footnote, Charlie emailed me about that footnote. I'm not saying that you cannot have an authentic existential commitment to Jesus and being involved in economic stewardship or be involved in, I don't remember what else I had on that list, but be involved in those things. What I had in mind are conversations I've had where people would be casting a vote for someone who I think is a moral monster and is absolutely committed to ungodliness. But their justification would be, well, he likes the environment. Well, first of all, I'd say bull. That's all political posturing. That's not genuine. That's not authentic, probably. But even if it was authentic, is this one issue so important to you that you will support, give your money, your vote, your campaigning or whatever, to support this particular individual who, in the end, is going to be so absolutely, completely destructive to everything important and valuable that we, from our perspective as biblical Christians. And I think I've seen that quite a bit, where this is so important to them that they will support the beast in order to be able to say, I'm supporting my pet agenda. It's not because that cause is illegitimate. It's the relative weight given to those things that I go, really? Then in what sense are you really committed to following Jesus and being obedient to him? Is that clear?
So yeah, I think that this is good. And so that's what, when I was mentioning holism earlier, I mean, like whole, like it seems to me like both of you are doing this and you're doing it well. I just have strange categories for understanding it, is that it is a mistake to think that we can carve up our belief system into discrete little chunks and make decisions about whatever only based on those chunks. I mean, I hear this and I hear like Quine, right? The unit of understanding is like a whole system, a whole theory. And I think that is kind of where you are, and that makes a lot of sense to me.
Exactly.
So, okay.
Exactly.
I think a distinction that might be useful to make, and people have sort of alluded to it, a couple people talking in the discussion that might be helpful in making the discussion, is a distinction between what we believe and why we believe it. If we talk about something being contra-biblical, that can describe an idea which, if the Bible is properly understood, is contrary to what the Bible says. A person's attitude can be contra-biblical in the sense that they might believe the right thing. It might be technically correct, but they might believe it for the wrong reason. They might actually think the Bible says the opposite thing, therefore they believe the right thing because they think it's the opposite of what they think the Bible says. I guess a little joke is not really a joke for those of us who fit this description, but like me. It says if when you're young, if you're not a liberal when you're young, you have no heart, and if you're not a conservative when you're old, you have no brain. That sort of reflects this idea that one can have wonderful motivations and terrible wisdom, be very foolish. And probably all of us who are old guys like Charlie have found ourselves... Well, you said I include myself there. Charlie, how old are you? Oh, okay. Well, I'm not quite 62 yet. But at any rate, we old guys have had a chance to observe ourselves, especially those of us who were Christians early in our life. I became a Christian in my middle 20s, a real Christian, an actual committed Christian, have observed ourselves really wanting to follow Jesus and really not having a clue what that meant. So... one of the things that confused me about Jack's paper, and I must admit I haven't finished reading the whole thing, but it is the idea that it would be very easy for me to what I read it, to hear Jack saying, all Democrats are going to hell. That this idea of leftist is if you believe things that Democrats tend to believe, and again, you got to talk about what kind of Democrat are you talking about, a New Deal Democrat or a whatever kind of Democrat, but because that has changed over time, but that it is that we are essentially, it could be interpreted as we are saved by knowledge. If you can get 80% or better on your catechism exam when you get to heaven, that's how you get to heaven. If you got the wrong ideas, if you don't pass your catechism exam, then you're going to go to hell. When in fact, you've got things like Romans, which says, who are you to judge the servant of another? To his own master he stands or falls, and stand he will, for the Lord is able to make him stand. He's talking about a weaker brother, somebody whose understanding is not really great, maybe thinks that God really cares about keeping Sabbaths in the sense that I don't walk farther than 5 miles or whatever on the Sabbath. Okay, he's wrong. He's got a mistaken understanding. But on the other hand, he's trying to serve his Lord. So I think making a distinction between what you believe and why you believe it might be helpful, because that allows for somebody having a commitment to Jesus, but just being thoroughly confused. And all of us who are old have been there, and I'm guessing those of you who are not old will realize you've been there when you get old, maybe in different ways. But if we could, maybe that distinction, what you believe and why you believe it, because you can have somebody who's an environmentalist who does it because to them, the environment is God. Fish are God. Or they're an environmentalist because they believe the God of Israel, the God who created the universe, commanded us to take care of his precious creation. And we're trying to do the best job we can with it and try to balance his other priorities too, because he has other priorities besides the environment. And so just to throw that out there, if we can, when we're talking about, if we can try to use those, the last speaker, I don't know your name, alluded to that, you know, maybe what if he does it for this reason? That's what I mean, why you believe it as opposed to what you believe. That if you accept that our starting point, the conservative starting point, is a biblical worldview, and deviations from that could be confusion, or they could be genuine rebellion against God, and trying to figure, I don't know how helpful this can be because I can't see into anybody's heart, but we could, maybe there's a sense in which we can say there's a level beyond which confusion is necessarily correlated with rebellion. I don't know if that's actually true. I remember reading somebody who said that he thought maybe there were no absolutes until it occurred to him that he could not imagine under any circumstances that having sex with a child would not always absolutely be wrong and evil. So if somebody believed having sex with a child, is there any sense, is it possible that such a person, or let us say, not the NAMBLA kind of person who thinks that it's a loving thing, but somebody who knows they're raping a child and hurting them. Is it possible for that person who believes having sex with a child is okay not to also be a rebel against God? Is it possible that person is is merely confused and not an utter rebel. I'm inclined to say there are some things, maybe, that are necessarily correlated with rebellion against God and are not, cannot, just very extremely unlikely to be foolishness. But I think there's a whole lot of things where you can be pretty confused and still have a commitment to God. And God will fix that. You're not going to be damned because you can't pass your catechism test 80% or better.
No, I think that's absolutely correct. And I take that for granted in everything that I'm saying. I mean, I think you can be a Buddhist or a Muslim and be a child of God. You're going to be very confused and you're going to be very wrong, but your heart may be right. So I would make another distinction. You have to distinguish between what they believe. Somebody, a Marxist, might believe in justice, but why they believe in that and why they're committed to it and what content they give to that is very different than what it would be for a biblical Christian. So you have to make that distinction. What is your basis for the value that you hold, as well as what is the value itself? And then you also have to distinguish between what I think and where my heart is. And there is no limit to how confused we can, I mean, you're right. I mean, maybe there is some limit, but I'm not in a position to draw the line between when somebody's confusion becomes a bad heart and they're not following God. That's for God to decide, not for us to decide. So nothing I say in the paper should ever be construed as saying, I know who's going to hell, because I don't. I don't believe in hell, but no one should take it as, I think I'm in a position to know who's condemned. I don't know who's condemned. Only God knows that.